Chapter 5. The Painted Angel. Bloodsworn. Pathfinders. The handhold was a good one, the stone of the ruined citadel still ruggedly impermeable despite being built on a storm-lashed coastline. It reminded Vitus Salicar of the hard rock of the Quadra Massif on Baal Secundus, the hostile range of Rad Peaks called home by the tribe that had birthed him. Granite hard and bleached of colour after thousands of years' exposure, the stone of the shattered tower offered plentiful handholds, but few were wider than the breadth of a finger. Salicar had climbed the tower many times, but this was his first attempt at the western facade. Erosion had worn the ocean-facing rock smooth, and truculent winds sought to tear him from his perch. Clad only in a pair of khaki trews, Salicar's transhuman physique was sculpted and pale, like one of the Adonai of the Grecian temples given life and motion. His muscled back was tattooed with a winged blood drop that writhed with every motion of his ascent. Salicar's arms were marked with similar devices at his deltoids and biceps, with his forearms inked with images of dripping chalices and weeping blood skulls. His hair was blonde, long, and pulled in a tight scalp lock, his features artistically handsome in their symmetry. The sea was 600 metres below him, a surging cauldron of thundering waves breaking against the base of the cliff. The advance of the tide filled deep depressions with foaming white water before its withdrawal revealed blades of rock beneath the surface. To fall would be to die, even for a transhuman engineered to be the perfect warrior by the genesmiths of the Blood Angels. And would that not be justice? Salicar pushed away the troublesome thought and craned his neck back to scan the onward route of his ascent. A lightning strike had split the tower 4 decades ago, shearing it almost exactly in two. That it still stood was testament to the craft of its ancient builders. The path directly above him was impossible, the stone loose and kept in place only by a miracle of confluent compressional forces. Any ascent by that route would dislodge the entire upper reaches. His current position at the edge of an arched window opening was tenuous as it was, but Vitus Salicar was not a warrior who refused any challenge once offered. Drazen had risked censure by calling him mad to make an attempt on the western facade, and Vastan told him in no uncertain terms that the sanguinary priests would not be held responsible for the loss of his gene legacy. So, up wasn't an option, but across. The opening was perhaps 6 metres wide, too far to jump sideways, but at the apex of the window was an overhanging corbel that might once have supported a long-famished idol of the Stormlord. 2 metres above, and 3 to the side. Difficult, but not impossible. Salicar braced his legs, bending them as much as he was able, and leapt upwards like an enraged fire scorpion. The stone at his feet cracked with a sudden pressure. It fell from the wall as he jumped, and for a heart-stopping moment, Salicar hung in the air as though weightless. Images of the shattered bones and pulverized organs Vastan had been all too graphic in describing flashed before his eyes. His arms windmilled for the corbel. One outflung hand scraped the edge of the stone, and his fingers clamped down hard. He swung like a pendulum, grunting as the tendons of his arm tore. Pain was good. It told him he wasn't falling. He closed his eyes and directed the pain away from his arm, letting it disperse through his body by repeating the mantra of flesh to spirit.
"Pain is an illusion of the senses," he said through gritted teeth. "Despair an illusion of the mind. I do not despair, so I shall feel no pain."
Athican had taught him that on Fraxenhold. The Prosperine mental discipline was simple but effective, and soon worked its magic. The pain faded, and Salicar opened his eyes, reaching up with his other hand to curl his fingers around the slender lip of the corbel. He pulled himself up smoothly, as though performing calisthenics in a gymnasia. He swung his eyes onto the narrow corbel and stood upright at the centre of the window's arch. A projecting lip of a pediment above him offered another way onwards, but that route presented no significant challenge. He dismissed it and turned his attention to a portion of stonework further over that had fallen from higher on the tower. Balanced precariously in a wedge-shaped gap in the wall, it sat on a rocky fulcrum like perfectly balanced scales. Salicar adjudged it wedged tightly enough to support his weight. Without taking the time to second-guess himself, he vaulted from his narrow perch and landed on the block. Right away, he knew he had been mistaken to believe it would support his mass. Though weighing several tons, it immediately tipped from position and slid from the wall. Salikar sprang away from the block and rammed his hands into a thin split in the rock above him. Skin tore and blood welled from his hands as he clenched his fists to bear his weight. The block fell from the wall in a cascade of debris, carrying a wealth of shattered stonework with it. It tumbled end over end before slamming down with a booming explosion of splintered stone and a 50-metre geyser of seawater. On the black stone quayside at the foot of the tower, heads craned upwards, little more than tiny pink ovals. The colours of their plate allowed Salikar to pick out his sub-commanders. Drazen in vermilion and gold, Vastun in white, Agana in black. The rest of his warriors were plated in legion crimson, their swords glittering silver in the dying sunlight. He turned from them and searched for another way onwards, but there was only the lip of the pediment above him. And as much as he desired challenge from this climb, there was no other way that wasn't simply suicide. Salikar eased one bloodied hand from the rock and grabbed hold of the projecting lip. With his weight borne, he withdrew his other hand and pulled himself up. From here, handholds were plentiful, and he reached the uppermost course of mighty blocks without undue effort. He stood atop the ruined tower and drew himself up to his full height, a beautiful painted man of idealized form. He lifted his hands above his head, looking down at the crashing waves, transient pools, and lethal rocks. Death hung in the balance of a heartbeat's miscalculation, and I might welcome it. Arms swung down to his side, Salikar leapt from the tower. The citadel of the Stormlord had been raised at the northernmost peninsula of the island of Damasek, a forsaken spit of lightning-struck peaks carved from volcanic black stone. The island was all but uninhabited and linked to the mainland only by a fulgurite causeway from the pilgrim city of Avadon. The citadel and the key at its base were the only man-made structures on Damasek. The key remained mostly intact, but the citadel was a ruined holdfast constructed in an earlier epoch around a solitary basalt peak. The pale stone of its construction was not native to the region, and the monumental effort it must have taken the pre-technological inhabitants of Molech to bring it here was beyond belief. One of the planet's oldest legends told of a mythical figure known as the Stormlord. Where he walked, thunder followed, and his fulgurine path had once been a pilgrim route across the landscape. The last portion of that route led to this peak, where the Stormlord had ascended on a bolt of lightning to the celestial ark that brought him to Molech. Before the dismantling of the Blood Angels Librarius, Drazen had studied a great many such legends in search of the truth behind them, and this was a myth dismissed as allegory by most of Molech's people. Most, but not all. A determined cadre of mendicants, whose number dwindled with every passing generation, still dwelled in the lower portions of the citadel, subsisting on the alms and offerings left by curious folk who came to gawp at the ruins. Drazen Akora first laid eyes on the citadel almost 2 years ago, and had trained here many times with Captain Salikar and the Bloodsworn. He found much to admire in the malnourished men and women who subsisted in the ruins of this barren coastline. Like the Bloodsworn, they cleave to a duty that appeared to serve little purpose, but would never dream of abandoning. They no longer called themselves priests. Such a term was dangerous in this age of reason, but the word was appropriate. There was something tangible in the air here. Not so long ago, Akora might have openly called it ethereal. But like the azure of the Librarius he had once proudly worn, words like that had been cast aside. The citadel stones whispered of something incredible, something he had never felt before, and only with difficulty did he resist stretching out his senses to listen to their secrets. 83 chosen warriors of the 9th Legion fought sparring bouts under the uncompromising gaze of Agana Sirkan, their black-armoured warden. These warriors were among the Legion's best, hand-picked by Sanguinius to stand as his proxies. Commanded by the Emperor himself, the Blood Angels had sent a blood-sworn warrior band to Molech for over a century. As great an honour as it was to serve a direct command of the Master of Mankind, its members were distraught at being denied the chance to fight alongside their Primarch against the hated Nephilim, in the Cygnus cluster. Akora shared their dismay, but no force in the universe would compel him to break his vow of duty. Salakar had accepted a crimson grail filled with the mingled vitae of the previous blood-sworn band of Captain Akeldama. Salakar and each of his warriors had drunk from the grail, releasing their predecessors from their oath before refilling it with their own blood to swear another. He put aside memories of his arrival on Moloch and walked to the edge of the quayside. Ocean-going vessels had once braved treacherous seas to bring pilgrims to this place, but many centuries had passed since any vessel had taken moorings here. The mendicant priests that constantly fussed around them parted to make way for him. Fully armoured in his blood-red battle-plate, even the tallest of them barely reached to the base of Akora's shoulder guard. They were in awe of him, but their fear kept them distant, and Akora was glad. Their fear left a bilious taste in his mouth. They didn't like that Salakar regularly climbed the tallest tower, but that didn't stop the captain. They couldn't voice their objections in terms of blasphemy or desecration, and instead cited the instability of its remains. Akora heard one of the mendicants gasp in terror and shielded his eyes as he turned his gaze to the top of the tower. He already knew what he would see. Vitus Salakar arced outwards from the summit of the tower, his outstretched arms haloed by the sunset like the pinions of a reborn phoenix. Akora blinked as Salakar's body was flickeringly overlaid with vivid imagery. A red-gold angel plummeting in fire, a comely youth borne aloft on disintegrating wings, a reckless sun careening across the sky on a sun chariot. He tasted ash and soured meat and bit back the urge to let his psyche power move through him as it once had so freely. He spat bile as Salakar plunged into a rocky basin of deep water the surge tide had filled only a fraction of a second before. The water swept back, revealing his captain kneeling on the black rock between a pair of spear-like stalagmites. Salakar's head was down, and when he stood upright, Akora saw the same fatalistic expression he had worn since their return from the preceptory line. Before the waters could rush in and fill the pool again, Salakar jogged over to the quayside and sprang upwards. Akora knelt and grabbed his captain's hand, pulling him up. Denied its bounty, the water boomed angrily against the stonework, showering them both with cold spume.
"Satisfied now?" he asked as Salakar spat a mouthful of seawater.
Salakar nodded.
"Until the next time! A less understanding man might say you had a death wish." "I do not wish death," said Salakar.
Akora looked back up the length of the tower.
"Then why do you insist on taking such needless risks?"
"For the challenge, Drazen,"
said Salakar, moving off towards the fighting men of the Bloodsworn.
"If I'm not challenged, I grow stale. We all do. That's why I come here." "And that's the only reason?"
"No," said Salakar, but did not elaborate. Akora felt the tips of his fingers tingle with a desire to wield powers now decreed unnatural. How would it be to divine the captain's true motivations? But another oath bound him against such a course. They came to where the Legion thralls had placed Salakar's battle armour, a masterworked suit of crimson plate, golden wings, and black trim. His swords hung from a belt of tan leather, and his gold-chased pistol was maglocked in a thigh holster. His helm was a jade funerary mask, as empty of expression as an automaton's.
"The mendicants would rather you didn't climb the tower," he said, as Salakar picked up a towel and began to dry himself. "They're afraid I'll hurt myself." "I think it's more the tower they're concerned with."
Salakar shook his head.
"It'll outlast us all." "Not if you keep knocking bits of it loose," pointed out Akora. "You fuss around me like a falling thrall," said Salakar. "Someone has to," said Akora, as Salakar looped a pair of glittering ident tags around his neck.
Even without his transhuman senses, it was impossible to miss the blood flecks on them.
"Is it wise to keep those?" he asked.
Salakar was instantly hostile.
"Not wise, but necessary. Their blood is on our hands." "We don't know what happened that day," said Akora, pushing against the nightmarish memory of awakening from a fugue state to find himself surrounded by corpses. "None of us do. But if there is guilt, it is shared by us all, equally." "I am captain of a Bloodsworn," said Salakar. "If the burden of guilt is not mine to bear, then whose?"
Yasu Nagasena's mountainside villa had been extended several times in the last year, with numerous annexes, subterranean chambers, and technological additions. It had originally been designed as a place of retreat and reflection, but had become an unofficial base of operations for many of the Sigillite's operatives. Instead of a place of solace for those who came here, it was often the last place on Terra they ever saw. Nagasena himself was in absentia on yet another hunt, and Loken's pathfinders had taken up residence. The walls of the room at the heart of the villa were covered in wax paper schematics retrieved from the deepest and most secure vaults of the palace. Hundreds of plans, sections and isometrics depicted one of the mightiest vessels ever adapted to the Scylla pattern construction schemata. The vengeful spirit had formed the core of the Lunar Wolves' campaigns for two centuries, a Gloriana-class war vessel of such power that entire systems had been cowed by the scale of the devastation it alone could unleash. The precisely inked lines of the plans were covered in hasty scrawls and pinned script paper. Choke points within the superstructure were identified, potential boarding points circled, and its regions of greatest vulnerability and strength highlighted with painted brushstrokes. The latter far outnumbered the former. Shipwright's plotter tables formed a circle around two warriors of transhuman scale, both engaged in heated debate as to the nature of the vessel they were to infiltrate. Loken tapped a stylus against the upper transit decks. "The Avenue of Glory and Lament," said Loken. "It's the approach to the Strategium. Plenty of companionways and gallery decks connect to it, and it's a natural highway through the ship." Loken's companion was clearly of a different mindset and shook his cybernetic threaded skull. His bulk was considerable, broader and taller than Loken, but with a noticeable stoop that brought his pallid features to the same level. His name was Tubal Cain, and he had once been an Iron Warrior. "Shows how long it's been since you stormed a war vessel," he said, jabbing a finger at the funnel points along the transverse transits. "A breach there will require a fight, something I was under the impression you wanted to avoid. Besides, any commander worth his salt will have rapid reaction forces stationed here, here, and all along here. Are you telling me the War Master's gone soft in the head as well as mad?" Despite his Primarch's treachery, Loken felt an absurd need to defend him against Cain's insult. The Iron Warrior had a knack for irritating people with his cold logic and utter lack of empathy. Loken had already stepped in to keep Ares Wojtek from strangling Cain with his servo arm when he suggested that the death of Ferus Manus might actually have a positive effect on the Iron Tenth. He took a deep breath to quell his rising choler. "The vengeful spirit has never been boarded," said Loken. "It's a battle scenario we never bother to run. Who'd be insane enough to board the War Master's flagship?" "There's always someone mad enough to try the one thing you've never considered," said Cain. "Just look around you." "Then where would you suggest?" snapped Loken, tiring of Cain's incessant naysaying. He knew his irritation was more directed at himself, for each of Cain's objections was founded in logic and proper diligence of thought. Cain bent to study the schemata again, his eyes darting back and forth, and his fingers tracing arcane patterns across the hair-thin lines of the Scyllan architect's quill. Eventually, he tapped a port-side embarkation bay of a munitions subdeck on the vengeful spirit's ventral aspect. "The lower deck was always the weakest point in other ships' defences," said Cain, sweeping his finger out to encompass the adjacent dormitory spaces and magazine chambers. "It's not presented to the planet below, so there's only going to be menials down there, gun crews, and whatever dregs have sunk below the waterline." "Other ships." "Ships other than the Fourth Legion," said Cain, and Loken felt a tremor of unease at the pride Cain took when speaking of his former brothers. "The Lord of Iron knew a warship without guns is a powderless culverin, and took steps to protect them." Tubal Cain had come to the knight's errand from the jail of Kangbar Mwaru, one of the Crusader host who had been garrisoned on Terra as a potent reminder of the Legion host's fighting in humanity's name. Cain's evolution of breaching doctrines during the storming of the glacier fortresses of Saturn's rings was still an exemplary model by which orbital strongpoints ought to be taken. His release from the Legio Custodes' cells had been Malkador's doing, but had only been approved by Constantin Valdor after rigorous psi screens had revealed no trace of traitorous rancor. Cain was not the only parolee from Kangbar Mwaru set to join this pathfinding mission, but he was the only one Loken had met so far. The Iron Warrior had responded to the treachery of Horus with stoic practicality, lamenting his legion's choice of alignment while understanding that his place was no longer in their ranks. "Yes," nodded Kane. "That's your way in." Loken traced the route a craft would need to follow to reach the ventral decks and said, "That means flying through the guns' fire zones, minefields, sentinel arrays. More than likely, but a small enough craft most likely won't show up on the threat or specs of cannons that size, and if a shell hits us, we'll be dead before we even know it, so why worry?" Loken let out a breath at the thought of flying through a gauntlet of ship-killing ordnance and detection arrays. As plans went, it was a risky one. But Kane was right. This was the portion of the vengeful spirit that offered the best way in. The sound of breath at the doorway forestalled any further discussion. A young girl in a simple cream shift, with gleaming black skin and hard eyes of pale ivory, stood at the open door, her hands clasped demurely in front of her. Loken had assumed she was a servant of Yasu Nagasena, but she carried a holstered pistol at her side at all times. He didn't know what position she occupied within the household, but that she was utterly devoted to the villa's master was beyond question.
"Mistress Amita sent me to tell you that Rasua is on approach," she said.
Tubal Cain looked up.
"The last of us?"
Loken nodded.
"Yes."
"Then let's see who else is walking into hell," said Cain.
Rubio and Varan came up from the sparring chambers carved into the rock beneath Nagasena's villa, slathered in oily sweat and making imaginary sword cuts as they debated the merits of Gladius over Chainax. Though both warriors had left their legion identity behind, their legion expertise was still invaluable. The interior courtyard of the villa was a place of peace and quiet reflection. A pool with a fountain in the shape of a coiled serpentine dragon burbled in the centre of gene-spliced plants and artificial blooms. Half a dozen robed servants tended the garden, and honeyed scents filled the air.
"So they're here," said Varan upon noticing Loken.
The former captain of the World Eaters was bare to the waist, his flesh a tapestry of knotted scar tissue, as if he'd been stitched together as part of some hideous experiment in reanimation. Tattoos coiled around the scars and over his shoulders, each one a badge of honour and a memory of killing. Mesa Varan had come to the Sol system at the head of a patchwork fleet of refugees, together with detachments from the Emperor's children and white scars. In the treachery that followed, Varan's loyalty had been proved beyond question, and Garrow had offered him a place within Malkador's Knight's Errant. His companion, Tylos Rubio, had been the first warrior that Garrow had recruited, snatched from the war-torn surface of Kalth in the moments after the 17th Legion doomed the Viridian Star. A warrior of the Librarius, whose powers had been shackled by the decree of Nykeia, Rubio had once again taken up psychic arms against the Warmaster. The loss of the Cobalt Blue still troubled him, and Loken knew exactly how he felt, though for very different reasons. His features were the polar opposite of Varan's, sculpted where the World Eater had been battered into shape, unblemished where Varan was forged by scars. His eyes were heavy with regret and loss, but the nascent brotherhood of the Knights Errant was awakening in him a sense of belonging that had hitherto been absent.
"Where are the others?" asked Rubio, raising a hand in greeting.
"Don't you know?" asked Kane. "Aren't you supposed to be psychic?"
"My powers are not parlour tricks, Tubal," said Rubio, as he and Varan fell into step with Loken and Kane. "I do not lightly employ them."
"Wojtek is already on the platform," said Loken. "He said the Aegis field needed calibrating."
"What about the half-herd?" asked Varan.
"Yakton is not on Terra,"
finished Rubio. Varan halted as they reached the fortified entrance of the tunnel cut through the mountain that led to the newly built platforms at the rear of the villa.
"You just said you didn't use your powers unless you needed to," said Kane,
unlocking the armoured portal and allowing the heavy door to grind into its housing.
"One does not need psychic powers to know when Yakton Cruz is near," said Rubio. "He has a presence that far outweighs his belittling epithet."
With Cruz's permission, Loken had reluctantly explained the old nickname of Half-Herd to his fellow knights. A warrior whose words went unheeded by the vast majority of the Lunar Wolves had turned out to have been one of the keepers of the Legion's soul. Cruz's days of being disregarded were over, but the name had stuck, and always would.
So where is he, then? Pressed Varon. He has a heavy burden elsewhere, said Rubio, one that grieves and shames him, but one from which he will not turn. Just like the rest of us, grunted Varon.
No one said any more, and they entered the mountain, following a long and winding tunnel bored by industrial-scale melters. Caged lumen globes were strung from the glass-smooth ceiling, swaying gently in sighs of ventilation. After a journey of 2 kilometres, they emerged into a steep-sided shaft cut into the haunches of a mountain, 100 metres wide and 3 times that in height. In the centre of the cavernous space was a single landing platform, large enough to take a storm bird, but not much else. Kneeling beside an opened bank of machine racks at the foot of the platform was a warrior in identical burnished metal armour to the rest of them. 2 articulated limbs at his side worked to sort tools and arrange couplings on a long length of oiled cloth. Another 2 mechanical arms curled over his shoulders, arranging nests of cables and preparing connectors to be reattached.
"Have you not finished yet?" asked Kane. "You have had ample time to make the necessary adjustments, and Mistress Rasua is expected at any minute."
Ares Wojtek did not look up or deign to answer, having now learned to resist Kane's baiting. He continued working with all 4 limbs, now embroiled in the guts of the machine. The arms moved with whirring mechanical precision, each one guided by the mind impulse unit attached to the nape of Wojtek's neck.
"There," said Wojtek, "not even Severian could find this place now."
Loken looked up as the shimmering Aegis field rippled with energy across the wedge of light above them. He saw no difference in its appearance, but assumed the Iron Hand had improved its performance in ways he wasn't equipped to register. The field's mechanics concealed the platform's location via a blend of refractive fields and geomagnetic scramblers. To all intents and purposes, the entrance of the landing field was invisible. Wojtek stood, and the servo arms arranged themselves across his back and midriff with a clatter of folding metal. Wojtek's left arm was a brutal augmetic from the elbow down, gleaming silver and kept lustrous by a regime of polishing that went beyond obsessive.
"If it's that good, will Rasua be able to find it?" asked Varon. "She already has," grumbled Wojtek, his voice artificially rendered and grating through a constant burble of machine noise. "Then let's be waiting for her," said Loken.
The 5 warriors climbed a switchback of iron stairs to the raised platform as the Aegis field rippled with the passage of an aircraft. A bare metal Valkyrie assault carrier descended on rippling cones of jet fire, deafening in the close confines of the shaft. The air became hot and metallic as it turned 90 degrees on its axis to land with its rear quarters aligned with the embarkation ramps.
"You got them all?" asked Varon.
"All 4, confirmed Loken.
"Does word come of where we're bound?" asked Rubio.
"Saturn 6th moon, said Loken, "to pick up Yacton Cruz."
"And after Titan," said Ares Wojtek, "the War Master."
"We'll learn that when we're assembled," said Loken
as the roar of the Valkyrie's engines diminished and its assault ramp dropped. 4 figures marched from its troop compartment, all in the burnished silver of the Knight's Errant, and armed with a variety of weaponry. Loken knew them from their data files, but even without that information, it would have been child's play to identify the 4 warriors. Braw Tyrfinger, tall, slender and hollow-cheeked, with a long mane of snow-white hair and a loping stride. A space wolf. Rama Karajan, keeping to the shadows, shaven-headed, sallow of complexion and dark-eyed, without doubt a son of Korax. The shaven-headed warrior with a forked beard waxed to points could only be Altan Nohai, an apothecary of the White Scars. And finally, Kalyon Zaven, patrician and haughty, his bearing was a hair's breadth from arrogant. Zaven's gaze swept over the waiting warriors as though judging their worth, a true warrior of the Emperor's children. Loken heard Ares Wojtek's Voxgrill blurt a hash of static and didn't need Mechanicum Augmetics to translate his bone-deep anger at seeing a warrior from the Legion that had murdered his Primarch. The 4 new arrivals halted at the base of the ramp, and both groups took a moment to gauge the measure of the other. Loken took a step forward, but it was Tyrfinger who spoke first.
"You're Loken," he said.
"I am."
Tyrfinger extended his hand, and Loken took it in the old way, palm to wrist. Tearfinger's other hand shot up and gripped the back of Loken's neck as if to tear out his throat with his teeth.
"Bror Tearfinger," he said, "you brought the silver wolf to bring down the rogue wolf. That's the best decision you'll ever make. But if I think your roots are weak, I'll kill you myself."